My name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement. Factory farming and the use of cages is rising in the African continent due to the ever-increasing consumption of animal products. This week's guest, Aurelia Adhiambo, is coordinating efforts in the region through her role as the Africa Coordinator at the Open Wing Alliance. In a really insightful episode, Aurelia walks us through the state of the situation in Africa and the unique complexities of campaigning in this region. A quick note to thank everyone who filled in our feedback form. We're really grateful for your thoughts and have implemented many suggestions already. We record the podcast about a month in advance, so you might not see them actioned in this episode, but hopefully you'll recognise the changes in the episodes to come. But for now, we hope you enjoy this one as much as we did. We're joined today by Aurelia Adhiambo, who is the Open Wing Alliance Africa Coordinator at the Humane League. She previously worked as the ProVeg Africa Coordinator, supporting members in Africa through the training program. Welcome, Aurelia.
Thank you so much, Amy. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, it's great to connect with you. I think this is going to be, very interesting. Obviously, such an emerging space working on animal advocacy in Africa. So keen to dive into the work that you're helping to support in that region. To kick off then, to start off, I'd just like to ask what a view is that you hold that perhaps most animal advocates would disagree with?
Perhaps that view would be that local outreach campaigns, especially the farm outreach campaigns or the door-to-door type of campaigns, are not effective. Let's just say that while they may not really bring out the results that is needed in a short time span, they are really quite effective in awareness kind of awareness creating and ensuring that over the long haul, people are aware that, you know what, animal welfare is important, considering the welfare of your animals is important, and so forth. So that's a view that maybe some advocates disagree with.
Do you think that's a view that's quite common in the context you work in, that people, the first thing they think of when it comes to animal advocacy is outreach and like one-on-one diet change work?
Yes, it is very common. You find that, for example, many of our Open Wing Alliance Africa groups have projects, or maybe they are funded by us to be able to do awareness creation amongst consumers and various stakeholders like farmers. So many of them already do that, yes, and it's common.
Makes sense. And do you just want to tell us, so what is the Open Wing Alliance and what are you guys aiming to achieve? Or what's your work look like?
So the Open Wing Alliance, henceforth call it the OWA, is a global coalition of all animal welfare organizations from all over the world that are working together to end the abuse of chickens. So basically, we do that through corporate campaigns. So all our groups together, we work through campaigning. We ask companies to make a cage-free commitment, which is essentially a public statement or a public policy that the company makes, stating that they commit to end the use of caged eggs from their supply chains, and they commit to animal welfare by a certain deadline. So that is the Open Wing Alliance in a nutshell. At the moment, we have over 90 organizations from 6 different continents, and we are working. We've so far secured over 3,000 cage-free commitments from companies, and more are just coming.
Great. And there's other coordinators in other regions, right? So you are for Africa, and what other regions are the coordinators situated within?
It's true that we have coordinators in most regions. We have the Europe coordinator, that is my colleague Annie Evans, myself being the Africa coordinator. We are hiring for the Latin America coordinator and the Asia coordinator. And very soon we'll also be hiring for the Middle East coordinator.
Great.
Very cool. And maybe for context, so if there's 90 organizations overall, how many of those are situated in Africa versus other regions?
So at the moment we have 23 organizations in Africa, from a total of 12 different countries.
Cool.
Great. And how did you come to be involved in the Open Wing Alliance? What did that route look like for you?
So I first knew of the Open Wing Alliance back in 2019. So I joined then as a member with a certain OWA group. So I was very active as a member from 2019 up until 2022. when my role was advertised, the Africa coordinator, and I applied and I was able to join as the Africa coordinator. So right now, working in this role, it has been 1 year and about 5 months.
And in terms of the kind of support you offer to the various organizations, what does OWA actually do in terms of supporting the local organizations?
Well, we do a lot to support our local organizations in the different regions. Firstly, we do so through trainings. So we offer a variety of trainings. We usually do webinars. We organize regular informative webinars for our members on various topics, especially within corporate outreach and campaigning, effective campaigning, and so forth. Other than that, we do offer grant support. So we provide funds for our member organizations. Of course, the grant cycle starts in September to October of every year through November. So all our members are eligible to apply for grants, either 1 year grants or 2 year grants, and they're eligible to continue applying every year. Other than that, we also offer training through global and regional summits. So every year we organize a global summit, bringing together all our member organizations from all over the world for an intense 3 days of training, of networking, of interaction, of fun moments, and bringing just advocates together. In addition, we also have the regional summits. So each region has its own summit. For example, last year we held the Africa Summit as an in-person event in Cape Town, South Africa. And later this year, we'll also have the Africa Summit, albeit virtually. So in addition to the virtual trainings we offer through webinars, we also bring summits in which we train. We also give out resources. We have the Open Wing Alliance resource site, which is like a library of all things corporate outreach, of all things Layer Hen Welfare, BCC. So our organizations have free access to the resource site, and they are able to access a variety of resources that they can use in their work.
That's great. So like a real sort of supportive organization, bringing those different, probably smaller organizations together who maybe need that little bit of extra help and the training and the funding, which I'm sure is well received in order to be able to actually carry out those campaigns.
Yes.
And so I think, initially those, the cage free work, which is obviously regarding eggs, and then also moving into things like the Better Chicken Commitment, European Chicken Commitment, and that's the work on broilers. Is that fairly new for the Open Wing Alliance to get involved in?
I would say yes, it's sort of fairly new, and it's mostly restricted to other regions of the world, like for example Europe, where there's been an already many countries and many organizations have been able to eradicate most cages from their countries and from companies operating in their regions. But for regions like Africa, where I focus, we are still not yet there. We are still focusing on corporate outreach and campaigning for layer hens, because we are still far off from achieving that goal or that target. Yes. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to incorporate broiler welfare as well.
Sure. That makes sense.
Mm. And how do you find these organizations? Do they often come to you and say, we want to join the OWA because we want to do corporate welfare work for layer hens? Or often do you kind of proactively reach out and find organizations that do work on animal welfare and say, hey, would you like to have this new program? What does that process look like?
Yes, thank you for asking. So basically we receive membership applications. So on our website, we have a page for membership applications. So basically we do not solicit for applications, but we receive them. So, for example, if a person, an animal welfare organization, finds out about the Open Wing Alliance and they're interested to join, they can check our website and fill out the membership application form, and we'll be able to get it and then action it. So that's how we typically operate.
Great. And what are most of the groups in the region originally working on from an animal rights, I guess, perspective? Like, for example, over here in the UK, we have a lot of charities working on like cats and dog shelters or trying to rehome pets. What's kind of the main animal topic in Africa, or specific countries within Africa, that you're trying to support organizations to move across to this type of cage-free work and work on other animals?
Yeah, so that, thank you as well for that. So a majority of African animal welfare organizations have typically worked on farm animal welfare, though there is also a niche of organizations like, let's say, African Network for Animal Welfare that were and are still are working on wild animal welfare. But for a majority of the organizations, they have been working on farm animal welfare. So the transition to working on cage-free has actually been easier because this is something that they already have been working with or are sort of familiar with. So that making that change or that transition has been relatively easy.
That's great.
And when you say they're already working on farm animal welfare, what kind of stuff is that? Is that your outreach on kind of like animal welfare or veganism, or is it something totally different?
Well, it has been outreach work, a lot of outreach work, farmer engagement, sensitization campaigns on different farm animals ranging from pigs, which of course I've noted as well, also companion animals like dogs and cats. A number of organizations have done a lot of campaigns, for example, rabies campaigns, advocating for vaccinations and so forth. So it's been a variety of farm animal focus per se. It's not just one particular animal. And of course, different countries have different organizations have different priorities.
That's great. So it's just kind of nudging those programs just to the most sort of impactful interventions as we've identified as things like cage-free. In terms of your grant making in the region, I'm interested to know how much money you have re-granted to Africa to date. Do you have those stats?
Yes, as of last year, we gave out about $400,000 in grants to African animal welfare organizations. And of course, we keep noting a phenomenon where the grant amounts and the demand for funding keeps on increasing because organizations are growing and their capacity to handle funds and their budgets keep growing. So we are noticing a phenomenon where these amounts keep growing every year. But in terms of the funding amount, so far we have given out over $2 million in funding consecutively, yes.
Wow, just to the Africa region?
That is as a whole. But in terms of Africa, we had last year, it was the previous year was around 390,000+, and this last year was around 400,000.
Okay, great. So a really significant portion of what the Open Wing Alliance is granting each year.
Yeah.
Yeah, 20%. It's quite a lot.
Great.
Yeah, and last year we funded 10 groups from Africa.
In terms of the wins that these groups have had, is anything notable in terms of have they managed to secure many commitments or, how's actually going on the ground campaigning with these groups?
Yeah, so looking at it as a whole, we have secured significant cage-free commitments from companies in Africa. For example, like the retailer Majid Al Futtaim operating in Kenya and Uganda made a commitment. Nando's and Famous Brands are well ahead of their deadline in terms of fulfilling their commitments. We've also had many organizations in active discussions with companies operating in their countries, and they are making significant progresses in securing the commitments with them. So yes, in terms of the developments with companies, the momentum is there. And we are getting progress, we are getting meaningful progress, and it's so good to know that also many organizations are up in active discussions with some of these companies. As you may know, sometimes getting a company to make the commitment may not be something that is achievable in one day or one month. It takes time, and it's a good thing that they are able to even maintain these relations with these companies and the discussions.
Yeah, great. I think that's a great kind of segue into the next section, just getting into the kind of nitty gritty, I guess, of corporate campaigns work in the region. How optimistic do you feel about corporate campaigns working well in Africa or the African context relative to something like the US or Europe, where you said it's obviously slightly more developed in terms of eradicating cages, they're able to move on to different topics. How optimistic do you feel about the corporate relations tactic there?
Well, I am very optimistic, though it's important to know that the setting or the landscape in Africa is vastly different from the US. For example, in the US, perhaps organizing a public protest with banners and cruelty logos and staging protests and marches and pickets outside the company is considered acceptable and normal. However, in a number of African countries, that is not the case. That would be considered a criminal offense. So many of the organizations have to resort to a sort of soft dialogue, trying to negotiate with the companies and trying to discuss with them rather than taking the very hard approach of really going hard on companies. So that is the difference in terms of like how different the US and other regions compared to Africa is. That being said, I'm optimistic because we are actually securing gains. For example, the other day, Unilever actually is reporting 100% cage-free usage in Africa. So this means that the consistent work that Africa organizations are doing in terms of engaging companies, whether it's through soft approaches, dialogue, trying to meet with them, also trying to do sensitization, is actually working. And the fact that also retailers in Africa are also starting to see this as a concern, and not only so, but even governments, even consumer bodies, starting to know that cage confinement is actually not okay, is a very good step in this direction. So yes, I'm very optimistic.
Mm. When you say sensitization, what do you mean by that?
By sensitization, it means just awareness, creating,
okay, got it.
Sensitizing consumers or creating awareness, yes.
Thanks.
I have a follow-up as well. I feel like, how's that worked from your coordinator position? Because obviously, as many people will be aware, the kind of Humane League approach is that bad cop doing the campaigns, and you're using trainings and grant giving to support organizations kind of with the same tactic, but I guess with a different approach. How's that influenced the way that you've had to create the coordinator role and position in order to support organizations in tactics that perhaps we're just less experienced in, I guess?
Yeah, so actually, as the coordinator for Africa, I work with different organizations differently. For example, with maybe our OWA groups from South Africa, it's easy to ask them, you know what, yes, you are targeting this company, we are doing this, it is okay to do a picket. So we can plan and support them, and we can help work with them, or create this logo, create this poster, this is the message, we organize this picket. It's easy to do that there. But I cannot say the same of another country, let's say Zimbabwe or so forth, where doing such a picketing campaign would be different. So I work with each organization differently, depending on their unique context and situation, and depending on also the work and their project that they are doing. For example, some organizations are more focused on research. For example, a study to assess the state of corporate accountability in their country. With that, of course, the support that they need would be to review to their documents, to help them in terms of this is the way to go, perhaps include this, how can we leverage this? While for another organization that is actually trying to meet with companies, it would mean something different, trying to help them draft emails, trying to help them secure the meeting, tips for presentations. So I work with this, which organization in each country uniquely and differently.
That's great. I'm so glad that this position exists. I feel like it would feel quite overwhelming to be a part of an organization, not really knowing any tactics or having any references to follow, kind of making your own path in a very challenging, potentially political or sort of social situation. So I think, I'm grateful that they have your support to help guide them through.
Maybe I'll ask a question. So you kind of mentioned that it's actually quite hard, or like sometimes like legally not possible, for some of the groups to apply pressure to food companies. So I'm kind of wondering, what does happen if they've tried the more soft engagement, meeting with the companies, and then things either break down or things they don't go very far? What would those groups tend to do then in terms of applying more pressure to get a commitment?
Okay, so actually, as the OWA, we try to resolve this issue by doing regional campaigns. So I actually lead regional campaigns. So, for example, we target one company. We try to target multinationals, which are located in different African countries. For example, a good example being Pick and Pay, whom we have been is a retailer based in South Africa, but operating in over a number of several African countries, especially in Southern Africa. So we target them as a region. For example, with this Pick and Pay campaign that have been running since last year, we even created a cruelty website, a website showing the abuse and the horrific situations that they expose their chickens to. We try to do it as a region. So we have one regional campaign leader and one who supports them. And of course, I facilitate and lead them. And we ask them through now the tough approaches. So if you're not able to really target Pick and Pay from your own country because of the political situation in your own country, we are still able to cover it because we try to do it as a region.
I'm interested to know about consumption rates, kind of sense of the real kind of facts and figures of Africa in terms of vegan alternatives, like awareness of the importance around higher welfare, like are there specific countries that are really passionate about supporting the farmed animal welfare work? What's the kind of general stats, I guess, of the situation of how farmed animals and veganism is perceived in the region?
Yeah, so I was actually reading a report about this, and the report stated that while you can consider a region like US, they consume an average of 280 something eggs per year, in Africa, it's still 42. So I was reading the report saying that we consume around 42 eggs, which is way below the compared to other regions.
Is that 42 eggs per year, per person?
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Per person, yes.
Got it.
Yes. Cool. Which is considered way less. And it's actually estimated that the population demand of Africa, which is expected to, I think, is it double or triple by 2030, compared to the production in the continent, does not, it's not, they do not match. But nonetheless, in terms of the animal rights movement, we are seeing a situation where we are increasingly getting aware of what is, of alternatives. There are increasing discussions of alternatives to meat consumption, to dairy, to animal proteins in essence. And I think this is expected to increase. Of course, countries like South Africa have really paved the way in terms of like the alternative protein industry, having really, for example, cell-based meat and things like that. And we are seeing a phenomenon where this is catching up. And I'd attribute this to the work that animal welfare organizations are doing as part of their sensitization work, campaigns, webinars, trainings. Many of them are also trying to bring up the topic. You know what? Why don't you eat less meat? Why don't you use these alternatives? And I also love the fact that other than focusing on perhaps these other alternatives, there's this focus on, you know what, even the indigenous local food that Africans eat is actually, some of it is vegan. How do you leverage that? So these discussions are taking shape, and it's exciting to see how this will come up in the next 10 years or so.
And in terms of like the other kind of, let's say, elite groups, obviously this will change a lot from country to country. Maybe there's a broad view. In terms of how are these kind of campaigns or animal welfare work generally received by people like politicians or the media or other kind of institutions that are important in society?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. So what is happening is that I've seen a number of OWA organizations actively try to bring stakeholders into their engagements. For example, when they organize a workshop, let's say to train farmers, you find that they'd invite government officials, they'd invite media, they'd invite academia also to come and join and take part in these discussions. And it's actually being very well received. Of course, the extent to which it's received is now of question, because you'd find that many are not really willing to fully say, you know what, let's ban cages as a whole. But the fact that it's being received well, even the ability to be able to hold these workshops, you know, you have to get approvals. You have to, for example, if you're holding public workshops, if you're doing sensitization with farmers, you have to get the relevant approvals. So the fact that this is happening, I feel like most stakeholders are increasingly coming into this discussion and this is likely to become even better.
Is that permissions from like the government or the local institutions?
Yes, that's
the local government.
Yes.
Has there ever been any that have been denied?
At my current knowledge, none that I'm aware of.
Okay, so it's just kind of a tick box to make sure that they have a good oversight of the types of, discussions and focus groups that are taking place.
Yes.
I guess, Mia, that seems like quite a big difference, though, to how advocacy and campaigns happen the way you're describing in Africa versus other countries where, like in the UK, you'd never need to ask permission to hold a workshop with farmers. You just do it. So I can imagine this level of like kind of bureaucracy just makes everything a bit more difficult and everything's a little bit longer, maybe.
Yeah, actually, let me clarify. You do not actually need the permission to hold the workshop, but when you're dealing with farmers in the field, for example, if you're going to really target them on the field, you need those kinds of relevant permissions or controls. For example, you need to be certified to be able to do that. But in terms of holding seminars and workshops, you'd find many countries do not need that.
Okay.
Okay, fine.
What does the industry look like in terms of, to what extent is it quite industrialized or quite rural and quite smallholder farms? And yeah, how does the concentration of farming look like? Obviously, again, changed a lot country to country. But yeah, if you can share a bit of that.
Yes. So actually, the state of intensive farming in Africa is much, much less compared to countries in the global north and western countries. Nonetheless, there is actually a projection that this trend is likely to increase, likely to grow as the demand for products like eggs and meat continue to rise. So the number as a whole, I'd say, is much, much lower compared to countries in Europe and US, but this is projected to actually grow. That being said, of course, in Africa, different countries vary. For example, you find that in South Africa and Nigeria, there is a higher number of caged intensive farming compared to countries like Kenya and Tanzania. So those specific figures and percentages vary compared to depending on different countries. So you find that in Africa, countries like South Africa and Nigeria are actually leading.
Mm.
Yes, and of course, countries in Northern Africa as well. So nonetheless, we've not really been able to get any OWA groups from North Africa. So we are not quite sure of the situation on the ground, but the studies and the research show that the number of cage intensive farming in countries like Egypt and Morocco are quite significantly high.
Right. And are there big kind of collective unions, as we also find in the global north, where the farmers are parts or perhaps investors are part of huge unions that create a very strong opposition to groups that are working against this issue? Do you get a lot of that pushback in the region?
So I'd give an example of Kenya. There are farmers' unions. Actually, they're usually called like poultry associations. For example, farmers in a different region come together, poultry farmers, and they use that association as an avenue to negotiate for better pay for their products, better wealth conditions and so forth, and negotiate a better rate in the market. So we have that in a number of African countries. Even like South Africa, there's this big council called Consumer Goods Council of South Africa. So we have that in a number of African countries. But in terms of the whether they've been against the cage-free movement, we haven't had that so much, though. Recently, what happened is that we had one of the Consumer Goods Council. I may not really mention it in detail because it's still under progress. It's still something that it's still being discussed. Came out to support some retailers in saying that the country is not yet able to transition to cage free and so forth. So yes, we do have those situations and challenges. However, it's not in each African country. For example, like in Kenya, you'd find that the poultry associations are actually open to cage-free or free-range farming because they believe it's better for the welfare of the animals and it has a higher production compared to cage farming. So, of course, that also varies from country to country.
Yeah. And in the places where they're pushing back because they say that the country isn't ready for cage-free, are the I guess that's on a supply side, right? They're saying that they would take too much time to transition to cage-free.
Yes, that's also on a supply side. They also say in terms that would also negatively impact the economy because the labor need wouldn't be there anymore. The production would be lower. The investment required is much higher. So all these excuses that we keep hearing, even from companies who do not really want to make the cage-free commitment.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are there other excuses that we hear regularly? I know in Europe, things like that would then increase the price for the consumer. There's kind of textbook answers to these types of complaints from the farmers. Do you get the same sense that there's just like a collective responses that they just keep pushing out? And do you think there's any validity to any of those?
Yes, there are a number of excuses. Some say, oh, they've invested so significantly, they're still paying loans for their cage systems, the production would be lower, there's no land. So we also hear so many of those excuses. But I like what we've done as OWA. For example, in the OWA resource site, we've actually created documents or created resources that the animal health organizations, if they are contacting companies, they are able to see, you know what, these are some of the most common excuses and this is how you can respond. We also typically do webinars in which we explain to our attendees, our organizations, that, you know what, you can say this when they say this. When they say that, oh, we do not have enough land, let's prove this. Oh, because yeah, these excuses keep coming up. And some also use other delaying tactics. So they keep, for example, they keep sending you emails. They keep extending the conversation to be via email. They keep postponing. Or, for example, we'll meet next week. Coming next week, they say, no, we are not able to meet today. Let's meet next week. So some use even other delaying tactics, which, yeah.
I think it's great that you have this resource, because I think when you first start working on corporate relations, I think it's quite, I don't know, it takes a while to realize that the companies just have the same excuses. I remember the first couple of meetings I went to and thinking, oh, they're really saying, like, you know, it would increase the prices or something. And they're quite convincing sometimes. So I think to have this support and know that it's not a unique excuse, it's not a unique set of tactics, really, to push back against us, is very helpful, especially when you're going into it quite new and you're not prepared for receiving such an opposition.
And in terms of when you're talking to the companies and kind of trying to demonstrate, or I guess trying to work with them, is the main argument for them, you know, this is what people want. People want higher welfare for animals. People want animals to be treated well. And is that the main argument? And do you ever reference other things, whether it's environmental, or do you reference progress in other countries? Yeah, what's the main kind of approaches that actually work with convincing companies?
So it depends with the company per se. For example, some companies are open to hear that, you know what, this will feature well into your sustainability plan because they are keen to really work on their ESG, that is environmental, social and governance aspects of their company. So some companies, when you tell them this is the right thing to do, it's good for animal welfare, it will feature well in your report, it is feature well in your in how people perceive you as a company, some companies are open to working with that. Others, of course, it has to reach a level where it escalates into a campaign. So where we threaten with them with campaign actions is when they are willing to, okay, they'll sit down and they'll listen to us. So different approaches, of course, work with different companies. But we find that in a number of cases, we have to keep on sending them emails. For example, with different companies we are reaching with, we send them up to even 6 emails telling them, you know what, your peers have made the commitment. Companies like XXX have made the commitment. You'd also do well to make a commitment. We keep being consistent with that until they listen and actually give in to our demand. So it varies per company.
Mm. Makes sense.
And is there any progress in policy work to sit alongside the cage-free campaigning? I know that's been quite a leverage point in Europe, where we get to a certain point where there's quite a high percentage of cage-free already, and then we can push it through as a policy or a law in a specific country. How far off do you feel like specific countries are in Africa from running policy work kind of simultaneously to the corporate relations work?
Actually, now that you've mentioned it, that is still quite a very far long way off as Africa. The legislative and policy processes in Africa are unfortunately very bureaucratic, very lengthy processes that takes years and sometimes decades. So in terms of engaging governments to make changes in laws and policies, I know that a number of organizations have tried to take this approach, but that has often been a very lengthy, expensive, bureaucratic process with very minimal feedback or outcome. Nonetheless, I'm happy that a number of organizations are actually trying to take up this up with institutions like the UN. There was this UNEA resolution that was passed sometime last year on animal welfare. So some organizations, like notably our OWA group, ANAL from Kenya, have been really consistent in following up with institutions like UN, following up to ensure that resolutions can be passed to support animal welfare and so forth. So in terms of really specifically engaging the government, that may seem challenging, but in terms of really engaging some institutions like UN, that is seemingly a promising endeavor. But at the same time, I'm happy that a number of organizations are actually doing studies. They are trying to do the legislative framework, understanding what the law says about animal welfare and cage-free. We also have some organizations like Animal Law Reform in South Africa that are focused on using the law to create positive change for the animals. So based on that, they are trying to do research to map out what is the corporate accountability situation like in this country and so forth. So in terms of the research in how on legislative frameworks, on laws and so forth, that is gaining, that is being done at the moment. But in terms of directly trying to engage the government, that is still quite a far way off.
Yeah, sure. It might even not necessarily make sense as a tactic if it is going to be so expensive. And it looks like you're obviously finding other ways around different types of policy work, which is great. So yeah, that's really interesting. Sounds like a lot of time and energy could be spent for not much gain there.
Yeah, and maybe I'll ask something that I've heard, and I think you kind of alluded to it before when you said companies often invest a lot in caged facilities because I think it costs quite a lot. And something I've kind of heard through the grapevine is that there is now in the US is almost 40% cage free of the layer hens. And there's been talk of some of these cage systems being actually taken over to countries in Africa and being used to develop caged hen facilities there. And is this something you've heard about or experienced? And like, what are your thoughts on this? And how much of a problem do you think this is in? Also, how can we stop it, maybe? So yeah. It's a lot of questions.
Yeah. Actually, now that you're asking is, I co-wrote an EA article with one of the groups from Ghana, where we spoke at length about the issue. It is true that the second-hand cage housing, and the cages really are being imported into Africa. And how do I know this? Well, there are some studies which have been done and will continue to be done on this. Talking to some of the groups who work with the farmers, who engage with them, they actually say that they are using these systems. They are importing their systems, which they consider much cheaper compared to buying really new cages. So that is actually a challenge. The only thing is that there's still limited information. There's still limited research and data on this phenomenon. Hence, now we need to support groups like, for example, the OWA groups to be able to carry out research on this. This needs to be talked about more often. And also from the aspect of the European countries, when, for example, you're banning cages, let it include a clause that you cannot really export these cages to these countries. So that should also be something that we jointly work on, both as the Africa organizations and the organizations in Europe and America, to ensure that, you know what? To ensure that in as much as we are reading cages from our own systems, we are not really exporting that to other countries, which is actually another evil. Because you find that, for example, maybe this cage was supposed to be, the lifespan was supposed to be 15 years, for example, and it's being exported when it's 10 years, yet the farmer will continue using it for another 10 years. So in terms of the welfare implication, what will this mean? In terms of the health of the exact egg that you, it's being, the output from the cage system, what implication to health will that mean? So these are some of the questions that there's limited research on, yet we need to take it more seriously and address it jointly.
Mm. And we'll definitely link to that piece because, yeah, I did see that on the Effects of Altruism forum. So we'll link that in the description. People who want to read that, I think it's definitely worth having a look at.
Yeah, definitely. And great job for the forum post. I know it's often intimidating posting on there. So congratulations for sharing that. I think it's going to be really, it's been already a really useful resource for the movement.
Thank you.
Just a little touch on that as well. I think in terms of global work, I wonder, do you feel like it impacts work kind of positively or negatively? How does it influence progress in the region? Because I think I've always been really fascinated by the statistics, and you alluded to some of the consumption rates earlier, that actually in terms of the impact globally that Africa has, or farms, you know, the numbers are still relatively low when you compare it to regions like the US, which are really high consuming. Does it kind of help you to reference the progress of other countries, or is there a sense that actually, you know, there's still so much work to be done in those regions on consumption that Africa's not contributing to such a significant part of the problem, that there should be much focus on it in the region?
So global campaigns are actually very, very useful. And I'll do this. For example, as the OWA, we do global campaigns. And from, for example, our team, we targeted Majid Al Futtaim, that's CAFOR, internationally, asking them to make a cage-free commitment, global cage-free commitment. So when they do that, of course, that commitment translated into a country like Kenya, where they have branches, and Uganda. So that infinitely makes work for the OWA group in Kenya to actually engage CAFOR, because they have already made the global commitment. So what you're asking them is now to also report their progress locally. And that is significantly easier than trying to make the company make a commitment in the first place. So global campaigns, I can say, they've made the work easier. They've given us the possibility that, you know what, campaigns actually work. There are commitments that have been made. Even, for example, when you're targeting a company in your own country in Africa, you can reference examples. You know what? These companies have transitioned, and this was only possible through global campaigns. So global campaigns have been very useful and have modeled actually regional and local campaigns, because groups are also motivated to carry out their own campaigns in their own countries only because they can see that it has worked at the global and regional level.
That's great. That's really great to know. And is it received positively or negatively from a business, from like a company perspective, when they get that information and the organization, the OWA organization, is going and saying, look, they made your headquarters made this commitment in the US, and now they want us to follow through on that commitment in Uganda? Are they do they receive that well as something that they just need to follow through on, or is there quite a lot of pushback there that they don't feel as though that's like relevant to their country?
It also depends with the company. For example, referencing Majid Al Futtaim again, in Kenya, they have been very receptive, very, very receptive to making the transition. They're actually always reaching out saying, you know what, we are getting this number of suppliers and so forth. And so it depends with the company. So some companies, of course, will barely respond to your emails when you send them, oh, what is your progress report? But a good number of companies with global commitments, especially the ones that the groups in Africa have been trying to reach out to, actually receptive. They respond to emails. They show, you know what, we are willing to be engaged with you to discuss this.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Mm. And maybe one slightly broader question on kind of corporate campaigns is, how much of your work is trying to get cage systems to go cage-free versus trying to stop cage-free systems going to cage systems? And yeah, how do you find that balance? I can imagine there's lots of pressure from multinationals to try get farmers to intensify their systems.
So that's an interesting question. And I believe through a multifaceted approach as the OA, we are trying to target all angles, because we are actually funding groups to do projects in their own countries that ensure that, you know what, first, their countries and their organizations and their regions remain cage-free, and for those that are not, to actually make the transition. Then through our campaigns and outreach work, we try to ensure that we are stopping cages, and we are actually ensuring that companies that have eradicated cages report on their progress. So I can say that we are actually doing all of that through different approaches, through now the organizations and the projects they do in their countries, through the regional campaign. And of course, as OWA, we keep reevaluating for ourselves. For example, asking ourselves, is our approach in Africa effective? We are keen on research. We are keen on always being up to date with the trends in the industry, the trends in the regions, to ensure that, you know what, even if, for example, we are funding the groups to do this kind of work, they work from an informed perspective. For example, when we do a webinar or a summit in Africa, we use it as a platform to work on really relevant and pertinent issues in the country, in the region.
What other kinds of strategies do you feel seem the most promising in the African context? I know you spoke about before this sense of sort of like one-to-one engagement. Is there any other work behind, you know, in the region, like institutional diet change work or just general awareness raising of the, you know, positive influence of veganism and vegan diets? What are the kinds of methods do you think seem quite promising?
I think one method that is and will remain promising is research. Just doing research to assess how the situation really is on the ground. For example, being able to know, you know, what are the existing trends that are in Africa? What is happening in terms of the poultry industry? What are the trends in the consumption of eggs? Because knowing this will automatically make everyone work from an informed perspective and ensure that the intervention is actually effective. So research is something that I'm keen and excited about. Another angle that I would say is this media outreach, involving stakeholders like the media. You'd find that, for example, many people do not really know the kind of pain and torture that a hen in a cage suffers from. For them, an egg is just an egg and it's a meal for them. But if we're able to bring in the media, and the media conduct sensitization campaigns, trainings, engage the public. Because I believe that many interventions, for it to be successful, you have to bring the downright consumer, the one who really consumes the product. So in as much as we also target the companies and they make change, ensuring that the consumer is aware, because ultimately it's the consumer who drives trends and patterns in consumption. So when they're informed to a level where they're able to make informed choices about what they consume, they're able to know, you know what, we are able to have better. So I'm really in support of media engagement. That is trying to find out, for example, is it as simple as a radio talk show? It is also something like this podcast where someone is able to know, you know what, this is what is happening and this is what I can do. So I support those two approaches.
Mm. Yeah, I think an interesting thing, a niche reference people who get it, is Family Empowerment Media, a charity that talk about family planning, and they broadcast via radio shows in Nigeria. And I think they have a huge reach and like huge listenership in some countries. So I wonder if something that's ever been explored for the, well, maybe in this case, the Nigerian context, which is media advocacy via radio shows, could be a very interesting angle.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Listeners, something to look into if you're based in Nigeria and want to host a radio show. And you kind of spoke earlier on as well, but generally you think the animal advocacy movement isn't particularly like big, or just like organizations are smaller, like less funded, and therefore there's less people involved. What do you think are the most promising ways to actually build a number of advocates and activists who are interested in campaigning for farm animal welfare or animal rights going forward?
I think if I'm interested to do that, I'd really invest in the region. For example, I've noted that, for example, having in-person events is a strategy that has really worked for many African groups. For example, an African conference or something, bringing in stakeholders from different countries. I've noticed that that is usually a very good approach. And you can see it with the success, for example, of the African Animal Welfare Conference, which happens every year. So I'd really invest, to answer your question, in terms of having, creating that movement organically, having workshops, meetings or conferences where I bring together people to discuss. Also, the approach of really publicity is everything. Sharing widely, sharing on social media pages, trying to get even regional people like someone from, let's say, Nigeria to share. You know what? Share within your networks, share on your socials. Slowly by slowly, people come to find out, oh, there's this institution, there's this movement that is growing and perhaps we can join it. So I believe those are very two effective approaches. And something that I've noticed also worked is funding. When you're able to fund groups to carry out something, they are able to carry out a project to run an intervention in a country, that is usually very effective because they are capacitated, they are motivated, they are able even to hire experts who can do the work in the best way. So that is also a very effective approach, yes.
Mm. Great. Let's look to the future then. And I'd be interested to know, are you looking to expand the Open Wing Alliance presence in Africa? You named some or suggested that there's some countries that you kind of struggle to get any organizations involved with the Open Wing Alliance in Africa. Is it a plan to expand and try and get representation right across the region?
Yes. Actually, that is one of our core strategies, to actually get representation from underrepresented regions. For example, we are keen on getting into North Africa, countries like Egypt and Morocco, where the intensification of farming is much higher than many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So that is that the core of what we really want. We want also to have OWA groups in such countries so that we can actually continue with our movement in such places where it's needed most, yes.
And do you have funding, looking, I guess, to next year and the re-granting, is it around the same amount that you're hoping to give out to African organizations?
So for that, I may not have the answer at the moment because we still have to see how much the groups need from us. So that is something that we can only find out once they apply. So based on the need of the demand and the demand amount is when we can be able to really decide and, you know what, see that this is the demand versus this is what we are able to offer.
And are the organizations quite reliant on your funding, or do they also have other sources? How long do you think they're able to kind of rely on the Open Wing Alliance grant before they have to venture out and kind of diversify their funding streams?
It's a great thing that besides the Open Wing Alliance, there are other funding sources like the Effective Altruism Animal Welfare Fund. There is actually the Movement Grants of Animal Charity Evaluators. There are these other grants from different charities that many groups actually apply for. So I've noticed concurrently with the Open Wing Alliance, many African groups also apply for funding from the Effective Altruism Animal Welfare Fund. So yes, the groups have a number of funding opportunities that they keep getting their funds from and they keep applying to. Yeah.
Mm. You said of the 20 or so groups, roughly how big are the groups that are part of OWA Africa? Is it tend to be like one or two or three staff or some a bit bigger than that? Yeah, I'd be just curious to hear about that.
So, okay, that's actually, if you'd asked me this question 3 or 4 years ago, I'd tell you that the average is 1 to 2 staff. But right now, because groups are getting more funding, they're able to hire more. So you find that some are actually also having full offices, they're able to hire 5 staff, they're able to have more volunteers and more interns who are working from them. So the situation is actually improving because as their budgets keep growing, as they keep growing in this work, they keep getting more funding and they're able to support even more. So this situation is just changing, yes.
Nice. So you think like if you had to put a number on it, it's like roughly like at least 5 staff, you think?
I would say 4.
Okay, cool. Good to know. Good to know.
The movement is growing, and this is a very positive thing for the cage-free movement as a whole and for the animal welfare movement, because as we are witnessing a phenomenon where we are having like the animal welfare organizations in Africa being more empowered, more knowledgeable, are getting more funding, they have more capacity. And this, I hope, really will translate into better animal welfare standards and the cage-free movement as well for Africa into the years to come. Yes. We keep growing. We are still securing more commitments. We are still also working on broiler welfare. So we are very aggressively campaigning for the rights of chickens and for the welfare of chickens, really.
Aggressively, but non-violently, of course.
Yes.
Always very competitive. Cool. Maybe then in that case, yeah, we can move on to some of the closing few questions. And yeah, I guess, what's a bit of news that you're kind of grateful to hear or excited about, maybe some progress in animal welfare?
Well, I'm just excited to see companies, for example, like Unilever being 100% cage-free in Africa. That's a very positive progress, because previously what we've been seeing is that companies are making a global commitment but are reporting in West Europe and the US but are not reporting in Africa. So the equity, and it's something that I've seen Mercy for Animals work on in their international cage-free equity report. So we are seeing a phenomenon where some companies totally disregard Africa. So to get into a situation where we are having companies that are actually reporting in Africa and they're reporting 100% cage-free, it's a very promising thing. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, it's so great. There's always a big concern, isn't there, that we get all these commitments, but then there just isn't the accountability to pull through. So I think leading the way with Unilever and sending that message that you are accountable for the commitments that you've made, I think is hopefully going to be really helpful. Great. Do you have any media recommendations, any books that have maybe helped you with even like coordinating so many different organizations? It doesn't have to be necessarily animal related, or blog posts, or any other media that our listeners might be interested to look up.
I think I'd really recommend people to go to the Open Wing Alliance resources site. I believe it's so underrated, but the information, the research, the data, the information available in the resources site is so amazing. It's a lot. And I believe any animal welfare advocate focusing on cage-free work or broiler welfare will really be benefit from this. So that's a site I'd really recommend people to go.
Yeah, great. We'll link that in the show notes to make sure there's a direct link to that resource page. Thank you.
Although I think you can only see the resource page if you're a member. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So non-members can't see it, but...
You have to sign up to this.
Got it.
Yes.
Do you have to be a member of the Open Wing Alliance?
Actually, yes, you have to be a member. But I think when you sign up, we are able to evaluate you and see if, oh, this is an animal advocate, so we can give them access to it.
All right. Got it. Thank you so much, Aurelia. It's been so interesting to getting to hear about your work and getting to understand how things are going. And yeah, thanks so much for taking the time and all your amazing work.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.